Blog Talk Radio.
And no matter where you've been or where you might currently find yourself, it's not over. When God is in it, there is no limit. New breed.
It's not over. It's not finished. It's not ending.
It's only the beginning.
It's only the beginning. God is in death.
All things are new.
All things are new.
Everyone can say they know someone who has died from AIDS. And I want to begin tonight by telling a story about a person that I knew that passed with AIDS. Her name was Frances, and what I knew about her story was this. She died in her late 20s. She was African-American. She was a mother, a wife. She was a faithful churchgoer, and by that I mean someone who attended church somewhere between 2 and 4 times a week. She contracted the disease from her husband, the last person you would think that you would get the disease from. He died about 6 to 8 months before she died. And I attended her funeral on New Year's Day, 1995. One thing I noticed as I entered the church that day was that you could hear a pin drop inside the church. The undertakers were treating the casket and the area around the casket very sterilely. They wore white gloves, something that I had never seen done before. And everyone attending the service seemed to be shocked by the fact that Frances had passed, including myself. And so as I was leaving the service that day, my grandfather, who had been her pastor at one point, and I walked out together. And there was one thing that he said to me as he was leaving. He had this totally blank look on his face, and I asked him what was wrong, and I'll quote his exact words, "She is not supposed to be dead." What he was meaning was he couldn't understand how a committed wife, a committed Christian, could be dead from a disease that he considered a gay male disease. Well, tonight we want to bury all those myths like the one that my grandfather had and set the record straight about HIV and AIDS in the black community. But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. So, ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome my guest tonight. We have with us Faith Mitchell. She's an AIDS outreach specialist and health educator. We also have Aaron. We're only going to use his first name. Aaron is a patient navigator, and he's also living with HIV. And last but not least, we have Tony Ray. He's co-chair of the Campaign to End AIDS, a youth caucus in Northeast Region, and he's also living with HIV. So good evening, everyone. Welcome, Center Stage.
Hello, Carrie.
Good evening. I think I'm having trouble opening Faith's mic. Good evening, Faith.
Good evening, Carrie. Can you hear me?
I can. Can everyone hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes.
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, great. You know, I want to begin tonight by, first of all, in the intro, you all heard me talk about my grandfather and how he believed in 1995 that AIDS was a gay male disease. What type of myths do people in the African-American community have about HIV and AIDS today? Faith, we'll begin with you.
Well, actually, that still is one of them. You will get a lot of times that when we're out on the streets, because like you have stated, I do outreach, where people be like, oh, well, I'm married. That doesn't bother me. I don't have to worry about that. And I love the fact that you shared that story about your friend that you went to her funeral. She was a married Christian woman. So you can be married and still be at risk because you get it from another person. We only know what our partners or our spouses do when we're in their presence. So a lot of people think that, hey, if I'm in a monogamous relationship, I don't have anything to worry about. And we want everybody to shoot for monogamy, but it's still a gamble because we never know what the other person is doing. So that is still a big myth in the community that as long as I'm monogamous, I don't have anything to worry about.
Wow. Aaron, what type of myths have you seen out there in the community?
They're various. One is it's indiscriminatory. It doesn't lay in wait for any particular person. It can strike anyone. It can hit anyone. Some people think that you have to have multiple, many partners to contract it, where really it could be the one wrong person who hasn't kept up with their partners or who their partners have been with. It's really shocking of the myths that are out there. I mean, there are so many. I can't even begin to write them down. I sometimes draw a blank. It's just basically due to stereotyping and just overall ignorance of how this disease is spread.
Tony Ray, what type of myths are you coming across? Tony's in the New York area. What type of myths are you seeing on the street in New York?
I mean, you have the basic, oh, I know what someone with HIV looks like. I can tell just by looking at them. There's also the misconception that a person is super promiscuous if they've contracted HIV. They're a drug user. They're a homosexual. The list goes on and on and on, and there are many different things depending on whom you speak to and where they come from and the people they associate with that will give you an insight to how HIV is looked at in their community.
Okay. You know, I got some information from the CDC this morning that was really, I can't say it was totally shocking, but I think it's something that we probably should cover. And they gave me something that's off of their website called a fact sheet. And I was surprised by the numbers, though, I guess a little bit, because it said currently 1.1 million people are living with HIV in the U.S. and an estimated 1,148,200 adults and adolescents. And nearly one in five of those, about 18%, are unaware of their infections. My question to you all is that number low? The fact that they're saying just 18% are unaware that they're infected. Could the number be higher?
Yes.
Yes.
Because we are talking about the people that are totally unaware. They're afraid to go in and get checked out because they're afraid of finding out if anything that they've done in their past is catching up with them.
Ooh. So that number, you would say, Aaron, is low?
Yes, I think there's more. Because
okay.
We can't really keep up with the influx of immigrants that come here because no one gets checked out until they're sick. So they're totally unaware. We have to admit, America has one of the best health care systems in the world. And there are people where they have to travel miles. I mean, many miles. I mean, at least a span of maybe what we would consider be like two city distances to get somewhere to get appropriate examination.
Tony Ray, in a situation we hear all the time where our government will report our unemployment numbers, and we know that those unemployment numbers are really only dealing with the people who are reporting to the unemployment office. So would you say that the same is applying to this situation, that these numbers are not even scratching the surface because where they're getting their reporting from is way off basis?
My personal theory about when it comes to reporting, I have to throw that disclaimer out, is that if you think of well-to-do communities or communities of higher like financial brackets, they want to maintain a view that we have a healthy community. There are things that don't exist in our community. HIV does not exist in our community. So say you have healthcare providers who will say they find out that one of their patients is positive. So if you find out that that patient is positive, maybe they don't report it. Maybe they take care of it in-house so that they can keep, you know, their numbers of our community is healthy and it doesn't exist in our community, when there could be a good number of people in those communities who are HIV positive.
Wow. Faith, I got numbers from the CDC today that said nearly 18,000 people with AIDS die each year in the U.S. I looked at that number, and I thought about how many people are in the United States. Do you think that number may even be low?
Are you asking me?
I was asking.
Yes, Because a lot of times they don't necessarily put that they died from complication of AIDS. Like if the person has pneumonia, they may just put that they died from pneumonia. So, yeah, I can say that, yeah, that that number is kind of screwed.
Okay, and Erin, I'll ask you to address this. When you're hearing that people die from HIV or they die from AIDS, typically it's not they're dying from the disease, it's the complication from the disease, typically I'm understanding. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. I've seen it quite a bit. For example, when an individual is infected with HIV, whatever afflictions might be running through your family. For example, if you have a high rate of diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, brain disorder, circulatory system, it attacks. As it grows in your body, it seeks out a weakness like you would an opponent's armor, and you exploit it. So that is one of the reasons when they say complications due to. Overall, the disease itself could be manageable, but what it attacks, liver, heart, kidneys, that's what a lot of people die from, because suddenly that dormancy of that particular ailment or physical disability is just totally exploited to where that person starts experiencing complications. And, it, you know, some people would just say, well, he died of a heart attack, you know, flopping valves or something, you know, arteries and so forth. But those were manageable before they contracted the HIV virus.
So if that's the case, the numbers are, like, probably dramatically off than if you know, any number of reasons that a person die could be caused by the virus itself, then that means most of the numbers that we're seeing, they're just reporting the cause of death at the time the person died, but not necessarily what it was related to.
Correct, because sometimes some people have died because they have never been checked for the HIV/AIDS virus. So they can't report what they don't have statistics-wise.
Wow, that is scary. That is scary. One of the other things that the CDC sent me today was what they called an estimated new HIV infections of 2010, and these were the latest numbers that they were reporting. So if it sounds like these numbers are, like, way old, I asked them, is this the best you got? And they said that because the process that it takes to compile all this data, that sometimes the actual report may be 2 and 3 years, you know, earlier. Okay,
yeah.
So is that, y'all found that to be the case?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So they said the estimated new HIV infections in 2010 by transmission category were 63% were males who had sex with other men. And then they said 25% were heterosexual. And then they said 8%, that's 8%, was IDU. And I think IDU stands for intravenous drug users, am I right?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. And then 3%, they said, were males who have sex with males and are also intravenous drug users. So are those numbers alarming, or do they seem off, or does that seem about right?
To me, they're alarming. Any number higher than what you can count on your fingers and toes, it's alarming because there's so much going out there, because so many of our young people are going to raves and parties where if you, you know, you just don't fit in if you don't use drugs. And they are just in that whirlpool of, you know, just, I don't think they mean to be promiscuous, but when you're under the influence of alcohol and drugs, all your mental defenses are just down. Everything seemed like the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And that is one of the biggest problems that we have.
You know, speaking of young people and them being promiscuous, what is the the youngest age of an HIV case you all have seen? I mean, what's the youngest age? Faith.
My youngest was 15, but I personally had to tell them that they were HIV positive. It was a 15-year-old African-American male.
How did you help? I mean, was the parent present?
No, the parent wasn't present, which that was the part that was really hard. It's kind of like he was an orphan because his parents had moved to Atlanta at the time, and he was staying with the older gentleman who was just so happened to be his lover at the time. And it made it really difficult trying to get him into care because he didn't have any of the paperwork. But I told him, but I kind of took him under my wing. You know, I left my phone on, so I would get calls 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you know, just trying to keep him level-headed and not to give up on me or run away and do something that would not be good. Because like Aaron was saying, it is a manageable disease, but we have put it out so bad to where people are like, okay, it's over, it's over, it's no way that I can live. And the gentlemen, they can tell you that, hey, you still can live with HIV, even though it's not something that you want to get. It does alter your life, but you still can live. And I was able to get him in the care, pulling some strings with the doctors, but it was very difficult. That was a very hard case for me, very, very hard for me.
Tony Ray, what's the youngest case you've seen?
The youngest case I've ever dealt with was actually 13 years old.
Male or female?
13-year-old male, same-sex contact. That is pretty. Yeah, that's the youngest age I dealt with.
Wow. Okay, y'all, we're gonna go to the phone lines. Area code 817-845. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Hi, you doing, Carrie?
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I just wanted to state that around here, the youngest ages as far as cases is 13.
Ooh. Wow. What do you think that is? I mean, someone 13 is contracting HIV. Is that, I mean, who could their partner be that's giving them that type of virus? I mean, could it be another 13-year-old, or does that, or was it someone much older?
No, it's same age. It's the same age. It's heterosexual. It's the middle school children that are having sex with each other, and they're not protecting themselves.
So for another 13-year-old, well, for one 13-year-old to give another 13-year-old the virus, you would think somebody's dealing with somebody much older at some point.
You would.
At some point, yes.
You would think, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. So did you know this person personally? Did you get to know them?
Yes.
Wow. How did they handle their diagnosis?
Hard at first, but it's been probably about 5 years now, and they're still on their regimen, and they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Wow.
And they're living their life.
Wow. Well, it is what it is. And, you know, and I seem shocked, y'all, because I haven't met anybody that young with it, but I know it happens. I've read it. You know, I've heard other people talk about it, but it's shocking to me because I guess I haven't personally experienced that. Thank you, caller. You got anything else that you want to add before we move on?
No, I'm just going to stay on the line and listen.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So, you know, you all heard her say a 13-year-old, and Tony said a 13-year-old. You know, the thing is, you know, parents are not, in my opinion, doing what my parent did when I was much younger. At 13, it was hard for me to be, like, anywhere other than school and home and church. So how do you think that the 13-year-olds of today are getting into so much that they can do these things and go undetected where the parents are concerned? Is that where the ball is getting dropped? Is that how, you know, kids as early as 12 and 13 are getting AIDS and HIV because the parents are not?
Yes.
We
have a lot of absentee parents, and there are single-parent households. Parents are working two or more jobs. grandparents aren't available. There are no after-school activities that they can constructively join. There's parents that are in prison, or they're going through their own personal episodes, battling their own demons with alcohol and drugs. And these kids are having to raise themselves because of, how can I put it, if they want to be part of their own family groups. So it's just like with gangs. You have a group of kids that are experimenting. They have no one to tell them the truth about sex and what it can lead to. They just go from the glorification of what their older peers are talking about. And when you had when the young lady had mentioned earlier, 13-year-old contracting from a 13-year-old, one of those 13-year-olds had to have come in contact with someone older.
Yeah.
It had to have been someone who has been out there. I've had friends who have passed away, but I never knew their entire story. And when it came up in conversation, there were some that were like, well, I was 12 when I first started getting involved with older teenagers or older men, period. And I was like,
can I chime in real quick?
It.
Sure.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Just your statement about that 13-year-old came in contact with, you know, an older person, I don't necessarily agree with that statement wholeheartedly, because there are children who are perinatally infected, but because parents are fighting stigma on their own, like, battlefronts, they don't tell their children what they have. And so when this child becomes of age where their hormones are raging, they're going to do their experimenting, as you said before, without anyone to tell them, oh, you have a virus inside of you, and you need to not only protect yourself from anything else out in the world, you need to protect other people as well. So I wanted to throw that into the mix as well.
Well, you know, now that you went there, I would think, but let me ask you this. I would think, so if I think when you say, I think the term you use is perinatal. Is that what you called it?
Yeah, perinatally infected.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, then that means from 0 to 13, you wouldn't know until you found out that you had AIDS. So maybe they had it for a number of years and they didn't know they had it, and somehow in a way they were tested and then they found out. But you would think, so that would be a long period of time to not have developed any type of symptoms, though, right?
But see, okay, so that's another misnomer that goes out there. Just because a person is infected doesn't mean they have symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the thing with HIV is, it is a virus that attacks your immune system. Though it is attacking your immune system, it doesn't mean that anything is actually visually happening to you.
Okay.
Like, there are people who are known as non-progressors, meaning they are infected with the virus, but their body maintains a homeostasis within them to where they don't need medication, but they're checked every 3 months, every 6 months, so that everything in their body is okay, so that they know where their levels are. So the misnomer that if you are positive, you will look a certain way or these things will develop with you and you'll be sick is not necessarily true with every case. Everyone is different, and their body handles a virus. Like, someone could have a cold and be rid of it in a day, while someone else could have the exact same cold, but it mutates in their body and they have it for like 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. And you know what? We want to deal with some of those terms to bring this all home, and like viral loads and CD4 cells and all this type of thing. Just a second. First of all, I want to remind you, if you just tuned in, you're wondering, what are they talking about? Well, tonight we're talking about AIDS and the Black community. We're talking with our guest, Faith Mitchell. She's an AIDS outreach specialist and health educator. We're also speaking with Aaron. He's an AIDS patient navigator. And last but not least, we're talking to Tony Ray, and he's co-chair of the Campaign to End AIDS Youth Caucus and Northeast Region. Okay, y'all, where I'm at on this is, and I must admit, I have done this show many times, I think at least twice, and I first in researching for this show, came across the understanding of what the viral load and the CD4 was, because I, for some reason, the previous shows, it just didn't come up. But let's tonight explain to people so that they understand when they hear terms like that, what that means to a person who is infected with the virus. Let's start with the CD4. What does that mean, the CD4? Can someone...
I'll do it. CD4 cells, those are can also be called T cells. Those mm-hmm. are the white helper cells that fight off infection. To do it in layman's terms, I always say they're the soldiers that fight off anytime you get sick. So those are your soldier cells that go and fight the enemy off that tries to enter your body. So
okay.
to be, like, easily for you to understand it, you don't understand, like, well, T helper cells, what is that? Those are the soldiers that fight off infection in your body, your CD4 cells.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's understand then healthy CD4 cells. And I'm going to open the line back up to the caller because she helped me understand a little earlier today about what a healthy CD4 count was and what an unhealthy one was. And I think the information she gave me was a healthy person CD4 is like 1,300 and above. Would y'all agree with that?
It's 800 to 1200.
I've heard of some people that were healthy that were HIV negative with a CD4 count of 500.
Ooh. Okay, so there's like
a healthy person's CD4 ranges anywhere from 1500 and above. You have some people who have a CD4, they're HIV positive, and they can have a CD4 of 700. They can have a CD4 of 500. But once it hits 200, then that's when you're considered to have full-blown AIDS.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up, because I got my numbers all wrong. For some reason, I picked up 1,300. Thank you. And so, you know, we talked about, so now we understand that the CD4 cells are the ones that fight off the infection.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so now we want to deal with the viral load. So explain, Tony Ray, what is the viral load?
The viral load is the amount of virus in a person's body per milliliter. So... if they said a person's viral load is 1 million, for every milliliter of blood taken out of a person, there are 1 million copies of the virus within that milliliter.
Yeah.
So
okay, now y'all going for those of us slow on that one, go back and repeat that one more time.
A viral load is the amount of virus per milliliter of
blood. We can barely hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay. The viral load is the amount of virus per milliliter of blood. So mm-hmm. when people go in for the labs, as we were discussing, they mm-hmm. take the vials and then they check for viral loads. They check for CD4. They check for CD8. They check for your liver function. They check for a lot of things within the blood. But when it comes to the viral load, it is the amount of virus per milliliter of blood.
Okay. So... Aaron, if you go in and you're checked, if you're in a good range, what will your numbers be?
If you're talking about the CD4.
No, we're talking about the viral load.
Viral load. Mm-hmm. You would really want those, if you're on medication, you want that to be at zero.
Okay.
That means it is suppressed.
Okay. Faith, if you're not doing so good and you're highly infected, what will your numbers look like?
It could be all the way up in the millions.
Wow. Okay.
It could be high.
It can be in the millions. It can be half a million.
Yeah.
But if your viral load is suppressed, if it's more than 50 milliliters, then that's what considered is undetectable. You're not as high risk. But when you're viral load is in the millions, and when it's up there, you are considered high risk.
Wow.
Yeah, highly infectious.
You are highly infected. Meaning, okay, say if you go have sex with someone and your CD4 is low, say if you have a CD4 of 25 and your viral load is 1.5 million, you are highly at risk of transmitting to that person. Now, you can have a CD4 of 1,300, which is a regular CD4, and you could be undetectable. That means the risk of infection is low, meaning the antibodies that you have in your body, in your blood, is extremely low.
Yeah.
So your infection, your passing of infection is extremely low.
Thank you, caller, for clearing that up. Thank you so much. Yo, let me ask you something. That said, you know, for somebody who's HIV negative, and, you know, very concerned about, you know, who they choose as partners, if you're HIV positive, at what point do you tell them if you're interested in a relationship with them of a sexual nature at some point? At what point do you tell them that you're HIV positive? Aaron.
Now, I would probably say first you just don't want to just jump out there with it. I would say before you have sex, get to know your the person that you're interested in.
Okay.
And you just find a way to bring up the conversation. You know, you could ask him, would you ever consider dating someone who's HIV positive? You give them the choice. Let them understand where you're, you know, where you're coming from. And from many people that I've met, after a good while of thought, not to mention education, you know, self-education, they read up on it, and they say, well, you know, I'm going to treat everyone like they're HIV positive and I'm negative. I'm going to I prefer to use protection, to use condoms, because just because you're dating for a few days, few weeks, doesn't mean that somewhere along the, you know, that that relationship is going to continue on. But at least you gave them the choice.
Okay. Tony Ray, when do you tell them?
What? I'm sorry. I'm like, is this really a question? No. That's a first date conversation.
That's a first date.
Okay, I live in New York, so it's a lot. I guess it's semi-easy, but I live my life out in the open, and I don't have time to dilly-dally with people because I'm generally always on the move.
Okay.
So for me, it's very much like, If we're going out on a date and we just met, we haven't just met, but, you know, there's the interest of dating. Like, it's on that getting to know you conversation. Oh, I'm the oldest of four children. I'm HIV positive. I like comic books and things like that. It's just, it's one of those things that is a characteristic of what I deal with on a regular basis, but it does not make up who I am. So for me, it's right on the first date. However, I disclosure is a very, very tough thing to get people to deal with, especially young people, the ones I've worked with and spoke with them about. So they have to, my recommendation is gauge whether or not you really will see yourself, like, you know, associating with this person past a sexual level. And because if the tables were turned, you would want them to tell you, just like they would want you to tell them. So it very much varies on gauging a person and who they are before you take that step.
And I totally agree because, you know, a young lady who did this show on AIDS before told us on the show, she said, you know, I tell people when I first meet them. You know, when they ask me for my phone number, I say, you know, I just want you to know I got AIDS. And I said, in my opinion, that's way too much information because – some people, first of all, are not mature enough to handle the information, I think. And second of all, you know, the moment you give them your phone number may not be the moment that you realize that they're just like a, you know, somebody you never hope to see again. And so I would just think, like you said, you'd gauge it, you know, gauge who you're dealing with, you know, whether or not this is somebody, you know, you really even want to pursue before you give them that information, but definitely before you engage in sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. That's it. I'm just saying that, y'all. I'm just putting that out there. But that young lady, I thought, was just way too giving with the information about her situation, and I think sometimes it was poorly received by people who were not mature enough to deal with the information. But
I was saying that I can definitely understand what you were saying about that. However, there are people like myself and other people who, listen, the virus does not make up who you are. It's just a part of you. And so she isn't really giving up her information. She's just forthright, like she would want other people to be with her. And some people can't deal with that, so to speak, which is why, in my opinion, I kind of feel like you were saying, oh, that's a little too, like, giving in the beginning of meeting with someone. But for people living with the virus, that's a good way to weed out people that you just don't want to waste your time with.
Okay.
Because I know some people who may do the, I work in the field of HIV, you know, and they gauge with, you know, hypothetical questions like, oh, do you know anyone with HIV? How would you treat them? Would you ever date someone? And that's how they get their feelings across. And some people are just...
What one of the stories that she told me, I think, is what probably made me draw the conclusion that maybe you're giving up too much information too soon. I think she said, you know, she'd gone to the club one night with one of her girlfriends, and she was out and she was having a really good time. And then she, you know, turns around and she sees these people staring at her, and it's somebody that she's met, you know, and obviously he spread it to these other people that he's around at the club that, you know, this person has AIDS. And so, of course, that dampened, you know, her evening, you know, and she left feeling really bad. And I thought, well, you know, probably if she had gotten to know him a little bit better, she'd have found out he was a jerk, and she never would have passed on that information. So that's why, you know, I just kind of felt after that maybe you just, like you say, gauge the person, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know your situation, so I haven't lived walked a mile in your shoes. So you may have just come to the conclusion that it's just not worth it to deal with, you know, I guess let me think about this before I say it like that. I think what I'm saying is you have lived it, so you know how you want to deal with it, I think is what I'm trying to say.
I can agree with that easily, because it's very much situational, like we said, with everything.
Exactly. And so, you know, looking at that, why do you think so many African Americans are afraid to be tested? Because that person who's probably stigmatizing her themselves may actually be someone who's carrying the virus. Why are we so afraid to be tested?
Fear of the unknown.
Ooh,
you feel like what you don't know won't hurt you.
Won't hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Some people feel, that if they find out, then that's going to speed up their process for dying.
Yeah.
And say that's not the case, but a lot of people really feel like, okay, once I find out, and they think about Easy, they're like, well, you know, Easy, he found out, and then next week he was dead. And then they'll go to Magic Johnson, which is one of those other men, and they're like, well, he got that money, so he's cured, he doesn't have it anymore, and I don't have money. But I'm like, well, Easy has some money too. So that's necessarily the case. But a lot of people really feel that, like, if they find out, then that means that they're going to die soon.
But isn't it technically can be a mental thing? Like, some people find out that they're sick, and the doctor says you have 6 months to live, and then the person, the next thing you know, they drop dead. Can it be mental if you don't know how to handle it, if you can't deal with that information and you don't process it right?
It can be.
Okay.
Yeah, I think your physical state has a lot to do with your mental state. If you are someone that's pretty much a fighter, who believes that this isn't the end, I had to find strength right away because, you know, as I told a friend of mine, back in the day when I was tested over 24 years ago, I had to wait a month before I got my test results.
Oh, wow.
So I was on pins and needles, and on top.
I remember
of that,
back when that you used to have to, when you get tested, it would be that 2 weeks to a month. And mm-hmm. So how did you deal day by day with the worry of am I aren't I?
I didn't worry about it until the day I was going in to the doctor. I just looked at each day as I did before I went to the doctor. I have a job to do. I have a family, brothers, sisters, mother, nephews. You know, I have a life. So as Tony said earlier, it didn't define me, whether I knew right then or not. It was just something that I was just going to have to deal with on that day when we have your test results, and this is what they are. Then I had some major life-changing moves to make in my life. Back then, in I think it was 1989, I didn't hear anything of a viral load. That was something that started coming around in the mid-90s, maybe late 90s. But the CD4 count was about the only thing that, you know, they had to rely on. And even then, they just told me, yours are good. Yours are high. They didn't give me any numbers. I didn't start hearing numbers until the 90s. So it was really, you know, kind of odd. It was like, okay, the doc says I'm good, so I'm just going to have to start changing some habits and lower my risk factor of either making this worse or passing it on to someone else.
Okay. Y'all, let's go to the phone lines. Area code 718-809. Good evening. You're on Center Stage. Area code 718-809. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Oh, hi. This is me. What's the sheriff was on? Yeah, my name is Larry. I'm a new resident in New York. And I wanted to give a shout out for Tony. And I don't know, it was a little bit of a delay, so it may have been answered, but I heard the question about how or why black people, it seems that they're scared to get tested today.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not sure if I'm answering the question again, but I believe that it's mainly because, we're still fearful of the stigma, the same stigma that we're perpetuating to others. I mean, homophobia, for one, that's out there. And it just opens the door. HIV is kind of like that gateway stigma, I guess, to other things that makes people think about drugs or other things that might be a part of one's life that they now have to talk about. And because I think we're long beyond the fear of dying tomorrow. I mean, I was diagnosed in 1986, where, you know, the fear of dying of AIDS was literally right around the corner. I knew people who were technically diagnosed and died in the same year. But now I don't think that the feeling of instant death is still there. I think that it's more the fear of just being denigrated, of being humiliated, of being ostracized by our families, of losing jobs. It's about changing our lives. And a lot of people, you know, are comfortable enough to acknowledge that, you know, others are walking in those shoes, but not ready to do that themselves. And you can prolong that as long as you want without getting tested.
Well, Larry, let me ask you a question. What is the difference, and you can answer this better than I can, what is the difference in not knowing versus knowing? Because at least when you, I would think, know, then you know how to conduct your life. You know how to get your life in order for whatever, you know, things that maybe, you know, you've kind of taken for granted or haven't really addressed, that you realize, you know, okay, now that I know this, certain things need to happen. But if you go around and you never know, aren't you just like, I mean, really putting yourself in a situation where you could just drop dead and not even know that you had something? Would that be the right thing to do? I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I'm just trying to understand when somebody is thinking like that, like, I don't want to know. It's almost like in the back of their mind, they think they might have it. And if you don't ever find out, then where are you putting yourself at?
I think for a lot of people, the fear of having it, the fear of that stigma is much worse than having the virus itself. I mean, people, I've known people who are living with HIV and AIDS who are much more willing to die in silence and seclusion than to live as a person with HIV, as, you know, being quote-unquote labeled as a person with HIV. I think not knowing and just walking around, obviously, you go under the risk of infecting others, of putting others at risk, maybe not knowingly, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And the virus affects and impacts everyone differently. I mean, there are ways with medication and service and research advancing in the way it is that one can live a full and productive life, having children, getting married, all the things that, you know, that we dream of doing as individuals, regardless of our HIV status, all of that becomes unlimited.
Mm.
The fear of knowing is just that, fear. But there are people, there are examples, you know, on the phone now and that we know every day of people who live with HIV, who live with diabetes, who live with other health conditions and are successful, empowered, you know, great people and supportive to others.
Wow. Well, thank you, Larry.
I mean, the bottom line is we just got to get over it and move forward. And I think the less we use stigma as an excuse and just realize our life ahead of us and realize it by living it, I think we'll be a better example for those following.
Thank you, caller. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
You know what? He brought up a lot of good points, y'all. And one thing I was thinking, would it be fair if the government said we're just going to level the playing field for everybody and we're going to demand that everybody be tested? Would that be a good thing to do, y'all?
Yes.
Mm. Yes. I agree. Everyone.
In New York State?
In New York State what?
Oh, I was trying to let him finish before I changed.
Oh, no, go ahead.
In New York State, it's actually a law that you be offered an HIV test with your medical visit.
Whoa.
Ooh.
I tested that theory, actually, and I went to an emergency room just to do it. And I walked in, and I was sitting there doing, you know, the triage and everything. And then the gentleman said, it is New York State law to offer everyone an HIV test. Would you like an HIV test today? And I sat there, and I was like, wow. All right, they're doing – well, at least at this hospital, which is Bronx, Lebanon, they were doing their job. This is the emergency room where they were literally asking people as soon as they come in, would they like to take the test? So the point is that in New York State, it has to be offered by every, like, medical professional, like healthcare setting. And, I mean, of course, you know, you have those that follow in, those that probably don't. But to see that that in my own like neighborhood and area that they are doing it, I was personally impressed and happy to hear that.
Absolutely. So, Aaron, you think that they should do that?
I think it should be asked. It's a quick way of finding out, for example, why are they there in the emergency room. Some people could say, you know, I got this nagging pain in my chest, and they just might think it might be just hypertension. There was a lady who was part of our peer navigation, which is just a step down from a patient navigator. And bless her heart, in a year's time, she had seen 16 doctors, but no doctor approached her affliction or ailment as being related to HIV. She said she said, thanks to the courage of one doctor who said, we have literally turned you inside out, bled you dry. He said, I want to try something. And by the time he was able to get the test results back, her CD4 count was down to 45. The woman was dying. And 16 previous doctors in a year didn't want to even think that it might be HIV/AIDS related.
So it's safe to say that sometimes even doctors are ignorant in their belief that you can look at somebody and tell that they have HIV.
I think they just didn't want to have to deal with it. So there are some doctors who don't want to get their hands dirty dealing with HIV. There are medical doctors who act, as a matter of fact, one of my case managers stopped and talked to me about two of her newly acquired caseworkers. And each one was treated very shabbily by a physician in the medical field. One didn't act like he wanted to even be near. and the other one just gave one of those old 1970, 1980s, what is the word, death sentences.
Wow.
Don't even try. You're going to die. And she said one was referred to the outreach center, and she said, I don't know how the other person found. I said, hopefully through word of mouth, because they weren't going to just accept that. And I was really glad that those people found their way to someone, I mean, to an organization that was going to help them look after themselves and gave them some hope. In which, you know, after we run our tests and everything, we'll probably see that, who knows, they probably had a high CD4 count. You know, it's just that, is, you know, they have the HIV virus now. And I thought that was horrible. I said, it just kind of blew my mind a little bit. I said, that is so 1970s, early 80s. You know, you find out, you know, like that commercial where the doctor tells the client, you have cancer. I say you got like 6 months to live, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, cancer was put in remission with treatment and so forth. Same thing could happen to either one of these two individuals. And I thought it was a horrible thing for them to do.
Absolutely agree. We're going to go back to the phone lines. We're going to pick up area code 682-551. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, how are you?
I'm good. I have a question about transmission. Like, can you get HIV through kissing, off of dishes and things like that? Like, what's the lifespan of AIDS outside the body?
Good question. Good question. We have an excellent panel to answer that, ladies and gentlemen.
This is Aaron. No. I say no.
Okay, Aaron's going to address that question for you.
No. I say no, but I want to hear some of the other panels also. I say no.
Okay, say.
You can't get it from dishes.
The answer is no. You can't get it from kissing. It would have to be some blood present, which a lot of times, well, your mouth would have to be bleeding and blood would have to get inside. So the answer for kissing is no. Off of dishes, no. It's okay to eat after someone who's HIV positive. You're not going to get infected from that. Actually, we have an enzyme in our saliva that helps to break the virus down. Now, HIV virus is present, but it's not enough to transmit HIV to another person. So the answer is no from kissing and dishes.
Tony Ray, do you want to address that at all?
No, she answered it just fine. I mean, unless the caller wants to know how it is transmitted, then...
Let's do that. Let's address for the caller how HIV is actually transmitted.
Through unprotected oral sex, anal sex, and vaginal sex, as well as sharing of needles. So that means if you're getting a tattoo and the needle isn't sterilized and was previously used, or you're getting a piercing and the needle wasn't sterilized and was previously used. Or if a person injects drugs into their veins, if a positive person used the needle first, there's still blood in that tip of the needle. And so if the following person who was negative was to use that same needle, they then expose themselves to HIV.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Okay, I can't get AIDS kissing you, but you can give me AIDS and oral sex with me.
Ooh, good question, caller.
Well, just to be clear, you can't give someone AIDS. The only thing that is transmitted is HIV. AIDS is a syndrome, just so we're clear. Because a lot of people say, you know, people give people AIDS. No, that is not how it works at all. The virus itself is transmitted, and AIDS is the syndrome once the virus has progressed in the body and has broken down the immune system.
Yes.
So
but answer her question, though. She's got to be question.
Yes.
If you can't transmit it to me through kissing, how is it that you can transmit it to me through oral sex?
Right.
Well, here's one. For example,
okay, I can
if
get
it,
that one.
If you, I'm going to let Faith answer this one.
Okay.
Go ahead, Faith.
Caller, you would have to be performing oral sex on him, and he would have to ejaculate in your mouth. You would have to come in contact with his semen. Now, if he was performing or she was performing oral sex on you and you were negative and they were positive, they cannot give you HIV from the act of oral sex.
Okay,
so
let me piggyback off that caller just a second. What about pre-semen? I mean, what do you call it? Yeah, pre.
Yeah.
What do you call that? Pre-cum? Or, Lord, y'all forgive me because y'all know I'm never described.
It's okay because that's how you know.
Got to get it right.
Right.
Okay. Pre-ejaculation and pre-cum, the HIV virus is in it. But she said I can kiss them and they and not get infected, but they go and give me head. Was that the correct terminology I'm using? With them getting you are okay.
I hear that.
But if you turn around and give them head, then you have some risk because you're coming in contact with pre-cum as well as semen if they ejaculate or just keep it, lack of a better term, nut. The people call it that, whatever terminology you want to use, ejaculate. So you would have to come in contact with their semen or pre-semen. But if they're giving you oral sex and they're positive and you're not, they won't give you HIV from them giving you oral sex. Does that help clear it up to you?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you, caller. Wow.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I think, Faith, that was the X-rated version, but okay.
I'm
anyway,
sorry.
Y'all.
I had to get a drink of water.
Okay, y'all, let's move on.
I'm sorry.
All right, no, that's okay. Listen, that's the first. That's the first thing I was going to say, y'all. But anyway, so listen, since we're talking about, you know, sex and how all of this is transmitted, one category of people that I worried about as I did the research for this show was that it wasn't mentioned in my research, but it came across my mind as I kept looking at the groups. One group that wasn't mentioned was the elderly. And I know that that's a growing group. They may not be registering in terms of high numbers, but I know that the elderly are contracting this virus as well. That said, would each of you all tell me what's the oldest case of a person that you've come across that was infected with the virus?
Whoa.
65.
Oh, really?
How?
I dealt with a 66-year-old.
Ooh.
And I just couldn't understand it. You made it this long. How could you become so reckless?
Well, they have Viagra.
Yeah.
That's exactly. That was, you know what? That was the segue to my next question, but okay, you're right. Go ahead. Viagra has opened the door for elderly people who probably wouldn't even be sexually active at all at this point. Now Viagra has given them new life in terms of a sex life. So do you think that is probably hurting a lot of elderly people because, you know, they have access to Viagra?
Yes.
Yeah, and this is are you talking, Tony? I'm sorry.
No. This was Aaron.
Oh.
I'm just going to quickly say that as we grow older, we should grow wiser because our immune system does not grow stronger. As all things in life, your body starts degrading. And, you know, some things that a younger person could contract, their bodies will be able to at least hold it at bay until they can get some treatment. But with an older person, they figure they just take everything as well. It's just one of the things about getting old. And you don't know what's really going on until you go to the doctor.
So are we, and I agree, so are we seeing these cases of HIV in elderly people coming up, like even in nursing homes?
I haven't heard too much about HIV, but I have heard of a lot of STIs, that's sexually transmitted infections.
Wow.
And that's because of their trading partners and so forth.
Elderly people?
Yes. As you said, that little blue pill gives them new life.
Yeah, and the thing, too, and maybe this is just how I call it playing devil's advocate. A lot of the older generation, they were around when you could just go get a shot. You know, you get a little, and at that time they were calling it VD, venereal disease. They weren't even calling it STD or STIs, which is sexually transmitted disease or sexually transmitted infections. They just went and they got a shot. And then they were clear after like a few days or a week. And so some of them still remember when that was. And I think they just haven't came aboard to like, okay, HIV is affecting them. That's what I really think. I think it's kind of a, and that's just my personal opinion, like a generational gap type thing when it comes to our elderly, because they didn't really have to deal with HIV like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, some people believe that there's actually a cure out there. You know, you can look on the internet and you can find, you know, sites that said, you know, there's an actual cure and, you know, blah, 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 and you can get this, you know, tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. Do you actually believe that there is a cure for AIDS out there somewhere? Tony Ray.
I'm here. I'm sorry. Well, no, my brain was still wrapped around the elderly thing.
Oh.
Because people
want to piggyback off that before we move on?
Yeah, I can jump on. I can piggyback on that real quick. Just because you reach a certain age doesn't mean you stop having sex. And in our society, if you reach that certain age, you are thrown to the wayside. You are not thought about because you are no longer deemed desirable. And the elderly who still, you know, who get it on every now and again, they have younger people that they'll have sex with, which is why sometimes they will become infected because, you know, that young person who's looking for, you know, maybe a little financial assistance, maybe they're actually into older people.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go and they'll have sex with that person unprotected because why? That is what that person has done their entire life. They've
mm-hmm.
lived in the world without HIV. So when it comes to like, oh, condoms, I don't necessarily need to worry about that because I'm clean. And so you don't always have those forthright people that there should be. And so it just goes back to, like I said in the beginning, just because you've reached a certain age bracket doesn't mean you stop having sex. And so that's why when people are like, oh, my God, elderly people are getting STIs, that's crazy.
Yeah.
No, it's not crazy. We as human beings, we're sexual beings. It's within our nature.
Okay. I receive that. I can accept that. Okay. Now that you got that out of your system, do you think that there's a cure for AIDS out there?
I think there's a cure, yes. Is it under lock and key? Most likely.
Really?
Because, again, personal opinion of Tony Ray, personal opinion of Tony Ray. Because if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, why cure something when you can treat it for long term and make more money?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Profit over people. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. You know, and it's funny you went there because, you know, I don't know if you all have ever heard of the New World Order or buy into that conspiracy theory at all, but, you know, the New World Order conspiracy theory says something to the effect that at some point the elites want to get rid of five, well, that's a whole lot of folks, y'all. And, of course, you know, you can't just get rid of 5 billion people one way. So some people have, you know, began to say that maybe AIDS is an easy way, you know, to, you know, get rid of a whole lot of folks. That said, when it comes to the pharmaceutical company, you know, not giving the cure would be something that would, you know, help in that theory, if that's correct, or aid in that theory. So do you think there's any truth to that? Or have y'all never heard of the New World Order?
I'm a big fan of Scully and Mulder.
Okay.
I believe, as Tony said, you know, there is money to be made. You know,
yes.
They might have an agenda, but
mm-hmm.
if they can make a whole lot of money out of it, I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Right.
I try and keep an open, broad spectrum of everything. You know, I don't believe in everything. You know how they say if you open your mind, someone will pour garbage in. But
ooh.
You also really, when it comes to dealing with human nature, human greed, then yes, I'm not going to say there's probably a cure, but I'd probably say that there are definite more avenues of combating this disease.
Okay.
But when you have the world overrun with hunger, ignorance overall,
mm-hmm.
and I don't mean someone who's duh, I just mean people who are totally unaware of what's going on in the world around them, they're considered as undesirables. and the world would be a better place, according to this order, if you get rid of those people.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Well, Aaron answered that one. I agree with that one. Y'all, we got a lot of ground to cover. And we are down to our last 50 minutes of the show. If you just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight for the topic, AIDS and the Black Community. Our guest tonight is Faith Mitchell. She's an AIDS outreach specialist and health educator. Also with us is Aaron. We're only using his first name. He's an AIDS patient navigator. And last but not least, we have with us tonight Tony Ray. He's co-chair of the Campaign to End AIDS Youth Caucus and Northeast Region. Okay, y'all, I'm not going to address these questions to all three of you all again. We're just going to try to cover a lot of ground, so I'm just going to address it to one of them, one of you all at a time, and then we'll move on to the next question. Okay, is the Black community more accepting of AIDS and HIV than any other group? We'll pose that to Faith.
More accepting than any other race? I would say no.
Really?
I think we realize that it's in our community and we're starting to do a lot. But to me, the Caucasian race is a lot more accepting than the African American race. Because living in the Bible Belt, because I'm down in Texas,
mm-hmm.
we deal a lot with like churches and stuff like that. And you still have like a lot of pastors and stuff that think that it's not going on in their church. So that's why we're trying to get in the church to even just to bring like a message, because in the African American community we always went to the church and that's where we like learned a lot of stuff, you know, that was kind of like the sphere, like in the Bible Belt part. So I say no when it comes to African American, and more the Caucasian race is a little more accepting than we are.
Okay. As we're moving on quickly, if you all want to piggyback off of something somebody else answered, feel free to do so. Tony Ray, you mentioned to me in our pre-interview something about the fact that you felt that the church wasn't doing enough, and that because of their stigma, you felt that they should be doing more, or they could do more. Can you elaborate?
Our discussion earlier was pretty much, my belief is that as Faith is your name, correct, right?
Yes, you're correct.
Okay. As she was discussing about the church, lots of communities of color, especially, will learn from the church. They get like a lot of their moral compasses from the church. And so if you have you know, their spiritual leader condemning a group of people for the way they choose to love, right? Then that's just teaching hate, pretty much. And so it closes the minds of people who would be open to, you know, love and acceptance and understanding. And even times by not having the conversations about HIV that's going on within their communities, that too is creating a stigma. Because if you don't have an open forum to discuss it, it's going to be pushed to the darkness until it's a giant monster that then comes looming out of the darkness to attack the people.
I understand that. Aaron, how important is a medication regimen with someone suffering from HIV and AIDS?
It's very important. We talked earlier that there's life after,
mm-hmm.
and after finding out that you're HIV positive or if you have AIDS. I work with a gentleman who has celebrated his 10th year living with AIDS, which was really a good long time compared to people who've lived just months after contracting, after going from HIV to AIDS. The medicated regimen is made so easy now. We have 3 and 4 in 1 medication pills. All you have to do is just take within 24 hours. Just keep it in your system. If you can take a one-a-day vitamin, you can take your HIV medication.
And so what happens if you skip it?
I would probably say really you would have to go a good while, because it's still, some healthcare providers will say, like, if you miss a dose, let's say you go out of town for the weekend and you misplace your pills, you left it on the counter, and you're going to be gone for the weekend. All I would say is that as soon as you get back home, start taking your medications. Try and have as few drug-free holidays as possible. those what I refer to as the drug-free holiday, it's my birthday. I plan to have a couple of glasses of champagne. Well, plan on taking your meds sometime afterwards, you know. Just stay on the pills. It isn't really that hard.
Gotcha. Faith, early detection of the disease can help avoid what types of problems down the road? So if it's caught early, how can that make the situation, how can that make the virus better if you catch it early?
I always tell people it's easier for us to help you to maintain health than to have the nurse you back. So early detection helps us to be able to watch you and see whether or not how your immune system works with the virus to see if you need to go on medication right away or if we can just watch you, like he was saying, every 3 months go in and get checked. We'll be able to see it versus you going in when you're sick. And then now we have to nurse you back up and get your immune system, get your CD4 that we talked about earlier, get those back up. We have something to work with when you find out earlier.
Also,
Tony Ray, how important is a support group once you've been diagnosed?
Support group? I don't know. That depends on the individual, because sometimes the people in the group might not relate to you or you might not relate to them. However, a support network is an entirely different thing that is incredibly important. I mean, depending on the character of a person, like some people are just really, really like neurotic, and so they know to take care of themselves and they can do it on their own. But some people need that extra push for people to reassure them, to let them know that they can make it and they can continue to fight on.
Okay. Aaron, once a person gets HIV, they have it for life. So how does the story of Magic Johnson confuse the black community where they think HIV is not as bad as we once thought it was, so therefore there's no reason to be tested?
I think a great misconception was going back to where he was so excited with his viral load and CD4 count that he said he was cured. And that threw a lot of people for a big tailspin, especially since they didn't understand the disease itself anyway. With him, it should look at as an example that Magic is still human like anyone else. Yes, he can afford the better medicines and regimen and so forth, but they're not going to create it especially just for Magic. Magic is going to have to go through trial and error just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was diagnosed back around the same time he was. So, you know, I certainly didn't have the financial means, but I was very fortunate after early detection. I went 7 years before I started a medicated regimen. And if with so many different protease inhibitors or nukes, non-nukes and so forth, as the little nicknames are. I think I went through like 3 different regimen changes since 1996, and I landed on one that about a little over 4, maybe 5 years ago. Virolobe 0, CD4 count highest was 1,100 plus. My current, I think after about with the flu and everything, I dropped like to 914. But that's still very good.
Really? Faith, is there any way with 100% certainty that a person who contracted HIV will know who actually gave it to them? So if you had, like, say, 3 partners, is there any way with any certainty that you can say, this one gave it to me?
I would say the only way is if the other 2 were negative, but you would have to see their results. Like the health officials, like what we call them, disease intervention specialists, the DIS, they wouldn't give you that information because HIV status is with HIPAA. You can't share it. So all they would have to do is get with those 3 people, and if 2 of them are negative and 1 positive, then you, bam, you got your person. But no, the answer to your question is no to 100% way. No.
Because if she didn't know what their status was, and just because one had died of HIV, it still didn't mean that that was the person that gave it to her.
Correct.
Okay, gotcha.
Correct.
I'm sorry? Who was that?
Oh, I just said correctly what you said.
Tony Ray, if two people, both HIV positive, come together and have unprotected sex, they're both carrying two different strains of the virus. How dangerous is that?
Really dangerous, because it's a thing called reinfection. Mm-hmm. Reinfection is pretty much you have a new strain of virus. Now, what makes that so bad is because we were discussing meds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are all these different classes of meds. They're generally tier ones, which are generally the newest ones that they come out with. Tier twos, a little bit older, but they still work. And tier threes are like, you know, those last lines. Like, we need to get you on meds to try to regulate this virus. And what happens is if one of the people that who is positive is resistant to an entire class of drugs, they're passing on that resistance to the person who has no resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So then by engaging in this sexual act, they could have just put themselves out of an entire class of medication, possibly one they were already on, and this will now affect how their medication helps their body. And it could make it to where this new mutation just makes it so that they might have to drop down to tier two or maybe even tier three. Who knows? So it's one of those situations where just because they're both positive does not mean that they should engage in unprotected sex.
Gotcha.
I would like
the
to
CDC, like I said, information earlier. I mentioned that they sent some information, and these are some of the things that was in that packet that they sent. They said that 1 in 16 African-American men will be diagnosed with HIV during their lifetime. Y'all, those are some high numbers. I mean, 1 in 16 African-American men will be diagnosed with HIV during their lifetime. Y'all, do y'all think that those numbers are correct, or do you think that may be too high?
Hmm.
Anybody?
I don't think it's too high.
I saw that as well, and I thought that was kind of high. And that was really scary to see that stat.
Mm-hmm.
That was very scary, because that kind of would be looking like that would move us. Yeah, I just think that one might be a little high.
Me too. They also said that 1 in 32 African-American women will be diagnosed with HIV during their lifetime. 1 in 32. Again, to me, y'all, that's high.
I think that's high as well.
You said what?
I said I think that's high as well. But
yeah,
it is growing, you know. And we did say earlier that we thought that the numbers were kind of off. So that's really scary when they break it down in that terminology with the stats. Because most of the time you hear percentage like, well, 57% of, you know, African-American women in like Fort Worth are infected with HIV. You hear percentage, but when you break it down to like 1 in every 32 or 1 in every 16, you like count out like 16 people, one of those persons is a possibility of they're positive. That gets really scary when you look at it that way.
Oh, absolutely. Is it safe to say then if you are sexually active, you are at risk regardless of if the fact that you're gay or straight or married or single?
All the above.
Yeah, if you're a human being, you're at risk.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're a human being. Yeah, that was Tony. If you're a human being, you're... Well, no. Now, if you're abstaining, you're not at risk. So if you're sexually active and a human being, you're at risk is what you're saying, right?
Let's remember, as I said before, even if you're abstaining from sex, there are the tattoos, piercings, those things. So you're still at risk.
Okay. Because the CDC, one of the things that they had in that the package that they sent me said, the CDC says that the best way to protect yourself is abstaining from sex and mutual monogamy.
Good luck with that.
It's a gamble.
Oh, yeah, y'all wrong for that.
When it comes to the mutual monogamy. It's a gamble.
Yeah, it really is, because one person could be being totally faithful, and the other person could be out there just, you know, right, just, you know, doing the fool.
Living
so you're,
it up.
Mm-hmm. This is true. And y'all, we don't mean to be negative tonight, but I think they're just trying to keep it real with y'all and let y'all know that there's a lot going on out there in the world of HIV and AIDS, and maybe the rest of us are not coming in contact with this information every day. What else did they send me? They sent a lot of stuff that I was very concerned with. First of all, and then another thing, y'all, let's go over what are the three stages of HIV. Erin, you want to cover that?
Okay. You have the initial infection, which is within the first, 6 to 12 weeks. A person is highly contagious. I'm going to up it a little bit and say the first 3 months.
Okay.
Then you have the what I call the kind of balancing off a little bit. And please, panel, if I'm a little off, jump in and help me.
Yeah, jump in and help me, y'all. If y'all see,
yeah,
if you
need the first 3 months, and then of course, where the disease is, I'm not going to want to say stabilized, but it's starting to replicate in the body, which takes time. And then, of course,
is that where you're talking about the clinical latency or the dormancy and inactivity period?
Yes.
Okay.
It's dormancy period. Thank you. And then, of course, the latter stages, this also goes back to high infections again. The CD4 count's dropped. Viral load is up. The white blood cells are nearly depleted because they're just getting beaten up by the HIV virus. And they also go back into an infectious stage again to where they're, where the disease is easily transmitted to a partner. So it's kind of like infection levels off infection again.
Okay.
But that's just trying to just break it down to the, how could I put it, layman's term.
Right. Aren't stage one and stage three, aren't the acute and severe infection period, which is that early stage, that first 3 months, and that last period, the symptoms are pretty much the same?
Yes, because a lot of people think that they just have a common cold or flu.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of the symptoms are, basically. You know, just cold or flu. You know, I'll be over this in a few days and be back to normal.
So things like night sweats, swollen lymph nodes, sore throats, rashes, fatigue, muscle aches, ulcers in the mouth, those are the kind of things that you'll kind of get on both of those stages, fevers, things like that?
Not in the first stage. In the first stage, you may have, like, an acute, like, flu-like symptom. Not all the time. And something that I want to, like, bring out is that first stage, we call it where the person is seroconverting. And what our test, when we test, it tests for the HIV antibodies. What your body is in the process of doing is making those antibodies. So in that first 90 days, you may not have made antibodies. So it can show negative when in actuality you're positive. So that's why they always ask, like, what have you done within the last 30 days? The last 3 months to put yourself at risk to try to see whether or not that would be an accurate result. So, like Erin was saying, you are highly infectious because the virus is out of whack in your system. But what the test is actually testing for is the antibodies. So if your body hasn't made those antibodies, although you're highly infectious, you'll get a negative test. So that's something that I want, like, people to realize, that if they tell you, if you did something within the last 3 months, be honest with the person that's doing your counseling so that they can tell you, like, okay, you need to retest in, like, 3 months to make sure that you're definitely negative and you don't do anything that will put you at risk.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. If you just tuned in, you come center stage tonight for the topic, AIDS in the Black community. We're talking with Faith Mitchell. She's an AIDS outreach specialist and a health educator. We're also talking to Erin. We're only using his first name. He's an AIDS patient navigator. And last but not least, we're talking to Tony Ray. He's co-chair of the Campaign to End AIDS Youth Caucus and Northeast Region. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentaryBlog. Okay, y'all, we're down to our last 32 minutes of the show. So we still got some ground to cover because there was so much information I wanted to put out on this show that so that, you know, no one can leave here without having the proper information about, you know, how to contract the disease, how to stay safe, what the warning signs are, what to look for. We wanted to put all that out there tonight. So, y'all, let's talk about pregnant women. Should pregnant women know their HIV status before giving birth?
Yes.
Yes. And they're going to test them actually twice. Like, if they're in prenatal care, they will test the mother in the beginning. And I want to say it's 2 weeks before they give birth to make sure that they didn't contract anything. So, yes, definitely a pregnant mother should know her status before giving birth. So that's part of the prenatal care.
Okay. Erin, there's a such thing called an STD and an STI. Can you tell us the difference between the two?
STD is just basically covering what are STDs? Chlamydia, herpes, syphilis, HIP 1, 2, and A, B, and C. Those are diseases. STI means the infection, what you have, you know, if you have one. Or could say HIV is an STI. But the difference is there's not much difference. It's just the letters. One is a list of the disease, and the other one is to tell if you tested positive for any one of those infections.
Okay, y'all, let's go back to the phone lines. Area code 216-256. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hello, how are you doing? I was just listening in to you guys. And you mentioned pregnancy. I do know in individual states some of the laws are different, but from my understanding, I think now it's an opt-out test. You have to let them know that you don't want to be tested. And it automatically becomes part of the prenatal process of being tested for HIV and AIDS when it comes to pregnancy.
So a mother who's about to give birth, are you saying, has the right to tell the doctor she doesn't want to know what her HIV status is?
It becomes a test out. They automatically will test. I know in Ohio, they automatically test for HIV and AIDS.
Gotcha.
And it's become an opt-out. You need to say, I don't want this test. You know, some people may say for various religious reasons that they don't want to do it or whatever. But it's an opt-out test, and I think it almost becomes a mandatory test where they automatically do it when it comes to pregnancy. Before, I think it went past the opt-out stage in Ohio because that was commonplace. Now it's common practice for it to be part of the prenatal process.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, panel, do y'all want to add anything to that? Thank you, caller.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case in New York? Is that the case in Texas?
In New York, mothers are tested for HIV as soon as like they know that it's routine testing because the state likes is all about no like perinatally infected children. I think last year the only reported like one perinatally infected child.
Really? Just one.
Just one. Wow. And like I said, these are reported as in like the mothers that went through all their perinatal care and, you know, went to the doctor regularly during their pregnancy.
Wow. That is very interesting that the state would allow someone to opt out on something so important because you would think that they would need to take certain precautions in the childbirthing process.
I'm not for sure they let them opt out in Texas. I don't know 100%. I know it is routine, but I wasn't under the impression that they could opt out, but I don't know that, like, in stone to say, oh, no, in Texas, they don't let them opt out. I don't think they can, but I'm not for sure because I just thought they run. It was like a whole slew of tests, like they just find, and that's what they do, and HIV was one of them. They could opt out.
Somebody's got some noise in their background.
Not me.
Okay. Is that you? Whose background is that? Okay.
Sounds like deep breathing exercise.
Done. I'm gonna close the mic. clear that up and see if we can't fix it. Hold on. Maybe that was a caller that just dropped off. We just lost Tony, so maybe that was his background. He's going to call back in. But people are generally diagnosed with AIDS when they have both a low CD4 count and one more opportunistic infection. Is that correct? Is that how it's said, Faith and
yeah,
Aaron?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
Yes.
So explain opportunistic infection. What does that mean?
Opportunistic infection is an infection or a disease that you get because your immune system was compromised and your body gave it the opportunity to get sick. That's the easiest way to put it so that people can understand it versus going into like, oh, well, you could get PCP pneumonia because that's one of the ailments you can get. But all it is that your immune system was so compromised that your body cannot fight off the infection and you got it. It gave your body the opportunity to get sick.
Erin, in our earlier conversation, and by the way, Tony, your phone line is open again. Erin, you told me in the conversation that if you had two cups in front of you and one was labeled type 2 diabetes and the other one was HIV, that you would choose HIV. Explain that to the rest of us who don't understand.
Well, for a lot of people, managing diabetes is really a labor that you, I mean, with HIV, if you know, how can I put this? All you got to do is just take your meds. There are some lifestyle changes, your diet, get proper rest, exercise, and so forth. But then, of course, you should be doing that anyway to stay healthy. With diabetes, oh goodness, I mean, I've been type 2 diabetic now for a little over 11 years, and that is one battle that I cannot cover up. I mean, I fail that all the time. You know, it's like your A1C is too high, which measures your blood glucose the same way you would measure your viral load or CD4 count. And I've been threatened by my doctor so many times about upgrading my medication to more powerful insulin injections.
Wow.
They said your pills, you know, as far as your pill medications. I'm just looking at, it has been so easy to manage my HIV. But it is I don't know, I think I'd rather do a tour in Iraq than to deal with diabetes. Because it's horrible, because of a couple of months ago, I just went on an eating binge because I have to watch what I eat. And it was like getting drunk. Mm. I mean, the next thing I know, I was ready to hurl, and I slipped, and I hit my face against the wall. And I felt drunk. I felt totally helpless because my sugar levels were so high, and my body was impaired. I've never had that problem with HIV. But it was like, you know, if I had to pass this bitter cup, yeah, I'd knock them both over. But if I had to choose between one or the other, I've done fine in the past 24, 25 years dealing with HIV.
I thought that was an incredible story. And I had to have Erin repeat it because I couldn't believe, I would have thought that diabetes was more manageable than HIV, but Erin says that HIV is more manageable than diabetes. So, you know, that was just a story I wanted him to repeat to you all. Okay, Tony, let me ask you a question. Some people say that they believe that HIV is man-made. Do you think that that could possibly be true?
Oh, no. And trust me, I've had conversations for like at least hours with people about this, and I don't know. It's the only thing I can come up with.
The only thing you can come up with is what?
Oh, I personally don't know, but as we know, biochemical warfare exists, and has only gotten more advanced as time has gone on. So who knows?
That's true. You know, because somebody texted me and said, you know, that in the Tuskegee instrument, I mean, the Tuskegee experiment between 1932 and 1972. And that, if people are not aware what that is, that's when we were told that, you know, scientists, government scientists, were treating black men with syphilis or treating them. I think they had syphilis, but they were being treated.
They
weren't given any treatment at all. They thought they were being treated, but they were actually being withheld from treatment so that the scientists could see how the disease would develop or progress. And so, you know, that's what somebody texted me. So, you know, decide for yourself.
Yeah.
But that was just one of the things that crossed my mind. But you told me a story, too, Tony, about the fact that in New York, a lot of people go outside of their communities to get tested. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, it was how we were discussing communities and how they're like, well, this number of people in terms of race, in terms of demographics and stuff like that, because the stigma attached to the virus is you don't want to be treated where you live.
Wow.
Say in your community there's this well-known HIV clinic, and everybody knows that is the clinic that positive people go to. If you it's one of those things that you're not going to go to that clinic. You are going to go out of your way to leave the neighborhood, to leave your people to know you so that you can just be another random face in the crowd. At least that's what I know from what some people have told me.
Wow. Faith and Aaron, do y'all see that being the case in the Texas area?
Yes.
No.
I'm going to go backwards and say a few years ago, yes, because I knew a lot of people that went to the expense of getting a private doctor so they wouldn't be seen going to the neighborhood clinic. And I just told them, get over yourself, because I'd rather someone see me going into the clinic to get tested and get treatment than to read my obituary and guess that's what I died from, because they're going to talk about you no matter what. But that was always a big issue. You know, I don't want someone to see me going there, you know, or getting tested or anything like that. And, you know, I think nowadays we've kind of grown up a little bit, you know, and, you know, as Faith was probably going to say, you know, she see a lot of people that are just like, you know, whatever. you know, go ahead and get tested, you know, or continue to get treatment. I think a lot of people have grown up a bit, but back in my day, like in the 90s or so, a lot of people were very secretive. They'd rather spend the extra money and go to a private physician than to go to a hospital with an infectious disease wing or a neighborhood clinic.
But
you still see it in a lot of which we'll have people cross counties. Like, you'll have people that live in Fort Worth, which is Tarrant County. They will go to Dallas County to get tested or to get treatment if they are positive.
Mm-hmm.
So that I still see it. And I think, too, it's why it's good that we do outreach, because you can also test the person on the van, where it's kind of like this discreet, we'll pull over somewhere, you know, like Little Woods or something, and test the person so people don't actually know whether or not we're testing them, or we could just be talking to them and handing them condoms. So I still see it. I still see it that people go to Dallas County and vice versa. Dallas will feel more comfortable coming over to Fort Worth, which is in Tarrant County.
And, you know, the thing that I would want to piggyback on that is, even though Aaron and both Tony Ray seem very accepting of their diagnosis and they're handling it, I would say it's probably some people out there that still, you know, 10, 20 years later have not come to grips with it and are still in the closet about it. So I would think that, you know, everybody probably can't handle it as well as you guys are handling it, because I commend you. You know, you sound strong. You sound like, you know, you have balanced lives. And I wonder, you know, if that is the case for everybody, and I would probably say probably not.
You're right.
just from
my caseload, there are so many wounded spirits out there. It's unbelievable. some people who, as I believe Tony said early in the show, have been ostracized by their community, their church, their family, and they just feel like there's no place for them to fit in.
And I agree. I absolutely agree with that. So one thing we want to be clear on, and we're down to almost our last 15 minutes of the show. You know, we want anyone who is, you know, not tested to definitely go and get tested. Because one of the things I found from research, it says that HIV is a progressive disease, meaning that it advances or worsens over time. If a person is infected with HIV and does not get treatment, it will eventually overwhelm his or her immune system and lead to full-blown AIDS. That said, panel, can you all, each of you, take a little time and explain to them the severity of being tested, the seriousness of it, and why it's so important based on the cases that you all have seen? We'll start with you, Tony. Is Tony still with us? Okay, Tony.
He was having some reception.
Oh, I'm here. I'm sorry. I forgot. I was on mute.
Okay. But you know, a lot of people are afraid, and they don't understand by not getting tested, their bodies is just eventually just breaking down, if what I'm understanding this progression to be. So explain to them the importance of, if you possibly think there's just the most minute chance that you could possibly have it, the importance of getting tested.
The importance of getting tested is to know. To know is to have the chance to do something. Even if it's already progressed, you can still do something to a point to where you can live your life and be healthy, or you can take the necessary steps so that you can become healthier than you are at this current point in time. If you don't know, you're just going around and putting yourself in at more risk, at more danger. You're not valuing the life that you have. Even though some people are like, I love myself, I do all of these things. If you love yourself, you'd get tested, you'd know your status, and you would treat, you would do everything in your power to protect not only yourself, but those in your community, or even the people you sleep with.
I absolutely agree. Aaron, you know, a lot of people, you know, go to the gym every week. They eat the right foods. They drink all the water, but they still haven't been tested. What is the importance of being tested? You can take care of your body all you want, but if you have that disease, being untreated in your body, what are you doing to yourself?
I believe I had a sociology teacher say, you're just TTing in the wind. It has to be balanced. The exercise and the eating well is all good, but it's even better to know what your status. That way you know how to confront HIV. You may go a period. I met a gentleman just about maybe a couple of weeks ago, and he beat me by 3 years before going on medication. He's gone a full 10 years between his diagnosis and beginning his first medicated regimen, and that was just cool. He said, you know, he said, I just started, he said the same thing I was thinking. I changed my habits as far as risky behavior. Exercise, diet, sleep, vitamins if you're into that, drinking less alcohol, abstaining from recreational drugs, all of that is good. You just got to know your status. If you go once, twice a year, give yourself that. Give yourself that leeway every 6 months at least. Go and find out what your HIV status is. That way, that good eating habits, sleeping habits, exercise habits won't go to waste.
Faith, for somebody who maybe thinks that they don't want to be tested, but as long as I do everything holistic, like some people, you know, may not want to get on the meds, but maybe they think that they can go the holistic route. Would you think that whether tested or untested, is ever safe to go and just do something holistic as opposed to actually being on meds?
I am a fan of holistic, and I know everybody's not.
So I think it depends on the person. Like, if you believe in the regimen that you're doing, there are a lot of natural things that are out there that does help boost up the immune system on a natural basis. But I would say don't do it on your own. Definitely get with, like, a holistic doctor so that you can do it under the care. Don't just be like, okay, you know what, my granny took these roots, so I'm going to take these roots. No, you still need to do it under doctor's care and still go the natural route with making sure that your holistic way is working. You know what I'm saying? Know what the virus is doing. Know what the what your CD4 count is doing to see if the holistic route is working, if it actually is building up your immune system. But I do believe in holistic medication, me personally. That's faith. Again, this is just faith opinion. I do believe in holistic medication. But it's something that I wanted to, like, expound upon, too, about with the testing. Mm-hmm. When you were asking everybody about the importance of getting tested, very important to get tested, but I also want to talk about a little flip side to put something on everybody's mind. Some people also use testing as prevention.
Ooh.
And testing is not prevention. So if you're still out doing those risky behaviors, you're like, oh, well, I'm okay this time. And then you go again, oh, I'm okay this time, and you think it's okay, but you never change the behavior. Eventually, it's a possibility you won't be okay the next time. So it's important to get tested, but don't use testing as prevention. Use it as a way to, like, okay, those things that I did, I put myself at risk, I was okay this time, let me try to change up so I can make sure that I'm working towards risk elimination or risk reduction, which is lessening the risk. So don't use it as prevention, because a lot of people are like, oh, well, I'm just going to go get tested to make sure that I'm okay. You may not be okay. Once you have it, then now we have another thing that we need to talk about. So don't use it as prevention, but use it as knowledge to know where you stand and what you need to work on and maybe not work on.
Gotcha.
What you need to work on.
Gotcha. Erin, explain to us the term risk factor as it relates to HIV.
Risk factors. Okay. Risk factors, this is my opinion, but I'm sure it's based in fact. Unprotected sex of any type. I just feel that no matter if you're going to be in physical sexual relationship with anyone,
mm-hmm.
wrap it up. That's the mm-hmm. best thing. That because not only do you have to worry about HIV, but you also have to worry about hepatitis, chlamydia, syphilis, mm-hmm. gonorrhea. And I remember a little over a decade more ago, they were talking about how the HIV virus, in comparison to the other STD viruses,
mm-hmm.
is so much smaller. Sometimes you're getting a double whammy for the buck. You know, you think you have syphilis or gonorrhea or any of these other STDs, and
mm-hmm.
turned out that HIV is piggybacked onto it as well. And it masks itself behind these other viruses, drug use, needle sharing, all of those are high risk because if it can transmit fluids or viruses, then it really doesn't matter how you got it, you got it. So you want to lessen your risk factors.
Gotcha. I was looking on the website of Campaign to End AIDS, and they had something very interesting on here, and I have to say I 100% support what they're saying. They said the Campaign to End AIDS is a diverse, exciting coalition of people living with HIV and AIDS, their advocates and their loved ones. Together, we're demanding that our leaders exert the political will to stop the epidemic in the U.S. and abroad once and forever. And I think I totally agree with their mission statement. I think that should be something that we all get behind the Campaign to End AIDS efforts to do, because that's absolutely, I think, what we all should be striving for, and that's to see an end to AIDS. And so in our last few minutes, any closing comments, Faith, Erin, Tony Ray. Faith, we'll start with you.
Okay, my closing comment, we talked a lot about tattooing, and I also wanted to point out about the ink. You have to worry about the ink. Make sure that they're pouring into the little caps and throwing it away, and they're not being cheap and reusing it. So always research where you get your tattoos. Make sure that they're using proper sterilization, and I've learned that there's also disposable barrels. They can use those and just throw it away, and they don't have to use that, and that they should clean their tattoo gun before they do every person. And also, if you have, because Aaron was saying about the other STDs, when you get those other STDs, it makes you more susceptible to HIV. That's because the bacteria is eaten away at the skin that could be a protectant. So just be careful when you come to other STDs. As well as if you are HIV positive, you do not want to contract one of those other STDs because it could be more harmful to you than if your body wasn't, if your immune system wasn't compromised. Get tested, know your status. Again, don't use it as prevention. And thanks for having me.
Oh, no, thank you, Faith, for being with us today. Aaron, closing comments.
Oh, respect and love yourself and love your partner, community. You don't have to be, I'm not saying be in that you're going to be in love with them, but mutual respect is important. A love of self, a love of your family and community. You only get one shot at being alive, and life is too precious. So take care of yourselves. Using the proper tools for the proper job is most important. If you're going to have sex, wrap it up. If you are going to, be monogamous, I wish you luck. I wish you all the best. If you are going to abstain, once again, best of luck to you. But if you don't respect and love yourself, you can't expect anyone else to be respectful and loving and honest with you. It's a two-way door. You either walk in or someone else walks out. So that's the bottom thing. And always remember, get tested. If you did it nothing more than once a year, at least do it that time.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Tony Ray, closing comments.
How can I put this succinctly? I would pretty much say people who are currently living with HIV, through whatever circumstances they contracted the virus, want to be treated with dignity and respect. For people who are negative and have made those jokes, those HIV jokes, or who may not be aware of the people in their presence, treat these people with dignity and respect, because you never know if the situation where the tables would be turned and you are now the infected person, and you just want to treat you as a human being with the same respect. You just want to be treated as a person.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say treat everyone with dignity and respect, and I'm pretty sure that we can do a lot to end this pandemic.
Absolutely. I think, and just to piggyback off what Tony just said, someone told me today that someone had posted on Facebook that they thought that there should be a Facebook page and everyone that had HIV's name should be put on it. And I told the person who told me that, you can tell that just by the comments, the person who said that must be young. Because as T.D. Jakes said, the older you get, the less critical you are of other people. And so I thought that person probably is someone who themselves has never even been tested. You know, so, but by grace, there goes I, is what I would say to that person. And I'm with Tony that be very careful about joking about such a sensitive subject because, but by grace, there go you. Okay, y'all. Listen, I want to thank my guests tonight, Faith Mitchell, Aaron, and Tony Ray for being with me. A reminder, join us here each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. Tell a friend, tell a family member, tell a coworker about the show. Also, a reminder, if you'd like to advertise with us here on Center Stage, drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Again, if you'd like to advertise here on Center Stage, you like what we do, drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Okay, y'all, in closing, again, thank you to my guests.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
And Tony and Faith, it's good to hear your voice again. And Tony, it was a pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
Okay, y'all, we got to get out of here. See you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.